This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's monthly show about comics, graphic novels, and sequential art. In this month's show, we're looking at the topic of toys and games and their connection with the comic book medium. Later in the show, I'll be talking to artist Bob Molesworth, whose latest regular comic book illustrating gig is for the Star Wars Lego comic, interpreting adventures of the Star Wars characters, but drawn in the style of Lego, and we'll be discussing that comic alongside his most recent work on a cyberpunk-themed adult colouring book and small press titles such as Dino Core, Endangered Weapon B, and The Psychic Journal of Time Travel. However, before that, I'm talking to artist Karen Rubens, who is in the middle of running a Kickstarter campaign for her comic book-themed card game Comic Turns. In Comic Turns, the players are given a selection of cards, each with a single comic book panel on them, and these can be used to construct narratives and all sorts of other games that the players can come up with. I'm also talking to Karen about entering a Shakespeare comic book competition and working on such anthologies as Alidard and The Phoenix. I last interviewed you about 10 years ago when you had your position as artist in residence at the V&A. So obviously an awful lot has happened since then.
Yes.
But thinking back at that time, do you see that as an important moment in your artistic career? Do you think it added anything to your perception of working with audiences or just being a comic creator in the world?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I thought as though doing the residency kind of gave me a sort of sense of legitimacy in a way. So okay. I was like, here I am going along doing my stuff like lots of people. And the fact that this institution was sort of behind me and people going, oh yeah, your stuff is cool. Oh, we want you to do things. Made me think that, made me actually consider making comics as like a viable career option. Mm. Whereas for years, it just seemed like, there really isn't a comic industry. No one's going to publish a comic. Just do your own thing and get on with it. And that was how it was in the sort of early 2000s, really, when I started. Mm. So having that was a big kind of confidence booster in a way, as well as all like the other things that it led to, because it was a great sort of way of introducing yourself to people or showing people what you've done, because just the name gave you kudos as well, no matter even what you did there. Mm. That gave you a sort of certain, oh, I was the resident of the V&A. Oh, oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
So it sort of gave you some kind of little, I don't know, USP, I suppose.
Mm. Well, and I suppose, you know, you said that you had concerns about the comics industry being a place where you could make a living. In recent years, you have had a regular gig in a regular British comic, which is drawing the strip. Hang on, I've got it in front of me. Tales to Give You the Shivers in The Phoenix.
Yes.
I guess that feels a bit like a real job.
Yes. No, it doesn't actually.
Okay.
Because it's fun. the shivers. Yes, we're not doing any shivers at the moment. Mm. I think the last one was put into the magazine in 2016.
Oh, so it's been a while, okay.
Yeah, it's been a little while, but Dan and I are still in contact with the Phoenix and potentially doing more things with them. But yeah, the shivers was great because it all started out with Daniel Hartwell and I putting together a short horror story for them, because we were like, there's nothing horror in The Phoenix, let's try it. And they liked that, and that one was Chatterbox.
Mm.
And it was a kind of a four-page story about this little girl staying at her grandma's house, and there's this little ornate jeweled box, and inside is her dead grandfather's set of false teeth. And in the night, she just hears the box rattling, and the teeth start chattering, and they say, put me in your mouth. put me in your mouth.
Nice.
Yeah. And so that was our first kind of shivers. And then we did a couple more for the Phoenix. And then it kind of became a sort of branded thing as the shivers. And we did quite a number of them over about 3 years. So there's quite a lot of shivers. There's enough to fill a volume.
Hint, hint.
If anyone wants to publish the shivers as a volume, please get in touch. But yeah, it's, it was a really fun thing to do.
Yeah.
Nice doing stuff for children as well.
Well, when you went into it, when you pitched them a horror story, did you have an idea of vaguely what the age range was that bought the Phoenix? And as such, did you sort of turn down the horror a little, you know, when you were aiming it at that audience?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You've got to aim things like horror at the right kind of pitch.
Mm.
The audience at the time was kind of seemed to be about 8 to 12. So that was the kind of age range we were aiming it at.
Mm.
And because there's a wide, wide range of what children find scary and how it affects children, you really have to kind of put it on that sort of scary but funny axis. It has to be balanced on that point so that it's a bit scary, but not too scary, and it's a bit funny.
Mm.
So sort of balance the horror. And I think in the main that we got it right because we did occasionally have a child that found it really scary or one whose parents wrote in and said, you know, this is a bit too much for this age group, I think.
Mm.
At least once that happened. But then a lot of the time you'd meet kids and you'd be like, well, did you find it scary? And they'd be like, no, it wasn't really scary. So as long as you've got some kids that say, no, it's not really scary, and other kids that say, oh, it was a little bit maybe too scary, then you've probably hit the right kind of level.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think in the writing and the art, it has to be pitched in a way that it's not too horrifying.
Hmm.
So try and make it a bit cute and funny as well.
And what was the process of collaboration with Daniel like? Did you kind of both come up with story ideas and then he would script it and you would draw it?
Yeah. Daniel's really easy to work with. He's been a friend of mine for many years. And we did a comic called Urban Beast together as well.
Yes. Yeah.
And so we found it quite easy to collaborate with each other. And what generally happened with the Shivers ideas is we'd get together and we'd sit around and think about what's scary. And we'd write ideas down and notes and we'd find a kind of little plot for a story. And then Dan would go away and write a script for it. And then I would draw it.
Hmm. And each of the Tales from the Shivers would have a cliffhanger because it would continue over more than one issue. Finding a place to put that cliffhanger and kind of building up to it and then continuing from it was obviously something that's relatively new to you as a creator who would have previously done all-in-one stories. What was that experience like?
Yeah, well, I have to correct you slightly.
Oh, okay, please do.
most of the Shiver stories were self-contained.
Oh, okay.
Those stories.
Oh, well, the two you put on your website both say part one, so...
I know there must be more. I'm going to have a look now. I'll look later, but... There were a couple that were two-parters. I think we did about 3 two-part
okay.
ones and all the rest were one-part ones. But yeah, I think the cliffhangers were really fun to do because it's all about where you put the scares and where you put the kind of story beats and the page turns to sort of make it fun. Mm. That's mainly Daniel's area.
Okay.
He just tells me to do things. I do them. It's not simple as that at all, but that's basically it.
And so not only, obviously, the Shivers in the Phoenix, but quite a lot of the work you do is featured in anthologies. Recent projects you've worked on include Alidade. Am I pronouncing that reasonably correctly?
Alidade.
I was pushing it up a bit.
Yes.
With Francesca Dare, Richie Chandler.
Dare, I think you'll find that
pronounced. and Richie Chandler and Mike Medaglia. And also The Japanese Village. So in each of those projects, you're not only contributing to an anthology, but also you're working with other people in terms of how your story or your contribution will work within a larger project. Presumably that's something that you quite enjoy doing, as it's something you've done a few times now.
Yeah, absolutely. I do really enjoy sort of collaborative stories. I like working with other people. I find it in many ways more fun than just trying to create things on my own in a vacuum. Mm. Alizade was quite an interesting process because we made the whole comic over the course of a weekend with no idea of what we were going to do. We just all went to Richie's for the weekend and we were going to make a comic of some kind. We didn't know what it was going to be, what it was going to be about, what kind of format it would take. And we came up with all the ideas, wrote the story, drew it, and got it ready for printing within the 48 hours. So it was a fun little challenge as well as a collaboration. Mm. And we all sat around the same table, drawing on the same bits of paper, which we often passed amongst us to draw our own characters on.
Oh, nice.
To the scenes, so they all interacted. It was probably the most collaborative process out of any of the collaborations I've done. Japanese Village was very different in that I was kind of given a story that had already been thumbnailed, and I literally worked from Angela Raitt's layouts to create the art for that. She'd already done all the planning of the how the images would go, so I just made them be. So that was a very different kind of collaboration.
And I suppose, you know, a project like that, in a way, as much like the Phoenix, you wouldn't necessarily know the kind of art or the kind of story that the part that you've illustrated would be nestling next to. Is that something that's kind of a nice surprise when you read the finished project, or do you sort of talk to the editor about that as well?
Not really. I was kind of vaguely aware of what the other parts would look like. But yeah, it wasn't something that we discussed, really.
Well, talking about the accidental nature of different stories rubbing up against each other, the most recent project that you've been working on is Comic Turns, which is a storytelling game using playing cards, where a person can create a narrative by choosing panels from a deck. And that developed from a previous playing card deck that you created called Hand of Fate.
Yes, that's right. So when I was in the V&A, as a sidetrack from a story I was already writing in there, I went to the print room where they had all decks of cards of different kinds. And I was looking at them because I was looking at the idea of magic and things like that. And it sort of occurred to me that you could make a narrative if you had a comic panel on each card and you could switch them around to make different stories. And I experimented with that and produced the Hands of Fate deck, which was basically a playing card deck with comic panels. And I took it to workshops where I used it to do kind of exercises about how to tell stories and how to make comics and about narrative structure and that kind of thing. And some other comics pros who do workshops that I know took them around as well, like Carrie Fransman, and found it useful for education. It seemed to me that a lot of the people I showed this to thought it would be great if they could actually buy one. And I was like, yeah, no, that would be cool. So I looked into the, I didn't actually look into the manufacturing of decks of cards, but they're extremely expensive to manufacture. And it was at the point where I was just like, I can't really do this. So I had to sort of leave it. And I kind of left it on the back burner for a very long time. And eventually I decided that like now's the time to do something with this idea and to sort of develop it into its own kind of thing, to make it into its own game. So I spent about a year kind of researching game design, play testing, looking into manufacturing and all kinds of things like that, talking to lots of people, going to games events, which are a lot like comic cons, except so it's basically the same kind of people, the same kind of things as a comic con, except there's not comics, there's games. But apart from that, exactly the same. Like, you know, the sense of community is very similar to comics community.
And there's your crossover audience.
Yeah, it's a crossover audience. And it's been really interesting. I've learned a lot of things. So I've developed the game a bit now. So it's at the point where it's its own game. So it's no longer a sort of playing card deck. It's a card deck, but it doesn't have the symbols and things, and it's a lot more accessible because I've taken out all the text, thought a little bit more about the sort of diversity of the characters and the kind of ways that you could use this to be a game or to be a kind of an exercise, an educational exercise. So the deck comes with some ideas for games in it called How to Play. It's not called Rules. There are no rules. And what I like about it is the fact that it's versatile and you can play with different sets of rules and you can make up your own games. So I don't like to say rules, even though they kind of technically are some rules, but you don't have to play with them. It's fine. So at the moment, after having done all these things, I'm now funding this on Kickstarter, trying to fund it on Kickstarter, hopefully funding it on Kickstarter, which is still running now, and it's until the end of, until the 13th of March. And so it's still got a little while to go.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be about 70% funded, which is positive.
Yeah, 70% funded and a week left to go.
Yeah.
So it's going to be close. It's not one of those ones that's like a runaway. It funded in the first 24 hours games.
Yeah.
But hopefully it will fund. It just needs the continued support, really, of people. But it's had a lot of positive exposure and there's lots of reviews and previews out there if people want to find out more about it. So it's around.
When you first created Hand of Fate, obviously you could use the cards as traditional playing cards. So you might have a selection in your hand when you're trying to win at poker or something. So you might have a royal flush and a couple of aces. I've no idea what I'm talking about, but it sounds plausible. And so the six cards in your hand might then create a random story. When you were thinking of things like that, was there any sort of commonality? For example, did all of the hearts cards have images that were to do with falling in love? Did all of the spades have something to do with death? Or was it more random than that?
It wasn't exactly like that, but nor was it random.
Okay.
It all came out of looking at sort of folk divinations for cards, for playing cards, and trying to illustrate those. So a lot of it is all, you will have success, you will have money, you'll have love, you'll have friendship, or the opposite of these things. So it's all kind of like friendship, betrayal, success, failure, money, and love, and all kinds of things. So it's all based on the divinations. So they're not entirely in sets or suits. It's just kind of my interpretation of those things. And I'm pretty sure one of them was, you will meet a tall, dark, handsome stranger. And that's the one where there's a very handsome guy in a muscle vest.
Nice. So you could use those cards for a tarot reading?
You could. And in fact, Leah Moore did do one for a tarot reading.
Amazing.
When I worked with Electra Comics, we did a small workshop for comics creators using a prototype of a digital comics creating program that was going to be used for Electra Comics. And Daniel Merlin Goodbury asked me if I would use the panels from my cards as a kind of just a random panels that people could then assemble to make comics for that workshop, which we did. And Leah was like, I'm going to do a tarot reading, see about the success of Electra Comics. And she did, and she thought it was quite accurate. So there you go. You can use them for reading tarot. Or you could. I'm not sure if you can now because you don't have the pips and suits. But I think you probably could if you use your imagination.
Nice. I was wondering if you knew of, there's a comics academic called Neil Cohen who is very interested in the way that comics are structured and believes, it's certainly one of his sort of ideas that he teaches, when he looks at a classic newspaper strip like Peanuts, he believes that if you were to swap the order of certain panels, it would destroy the meaning of a comic. When ironically, what you're doing is actually saying, it doesn't matter what order the panels are in, you can create a narrative from whatever you've been given.
Yes, that's interesting. I think in a way, he's right. I think it would destroy the original meaning of a narrative, but it might create a new meaning.
Exactly.
And there are certain circumstances in which the meaning would be sort of illogical. So if you had a character, like if it was Peanuts, and you had somebody's pitching the baseball and then somebody's trying to hit it then yes, it might be illogical if you change the orders of those panels. So someone got hit with a baseball first before someone had thrown it.
Hmm.
But if you consciously decide that you're going to make panels that can be read in any order, then you won't put things like that in them.
Hmm. So in that case, when you were creating the panels, did you find that some of the images in a way were too specific? You had to make them vaguer so that they could be read in different ways?
Yes. What I really wanted was to make the characters almost like ciphers for you to decide who they were and what they were doing, and to make everything about it as kind of vague as possible.
Mm.
So there are a few kind of locations, but most of them have kind of blank backgrounds. And there are things like someone's looking at a piece of paper and crying, and you don't know why, because you can't see what's on the paper. It could be anything.
Mm.
And that kind of thing. So there's definitely a conscious making them being able to be read in multiple ways.
Mm.
Some of the things I found you could have them be read in even more multiple ways that I wasn't intending, just by taking out the text. So, for example, there's quite a few cards where one of the characters is standing next to like a prophet's chart. And by taking out the word prophets, it meant that could be anything. It could be like a chart.
Hmm.
It could be a chart of prophets. It could be like a mountain range. It could be anything that you wanted, or a picture that's on the wall or anything like that.
Hmm.
And that opened up kind of even more possibilities for how the cards could be interpreted. And one of the other things that was kind of funny was I started off with some of the cards were taking place outside a betting shop. And there's this character that's either gone in there and made loads of money or lost loads of money or various other things. And the shop was called You Bet, and it was written on the side of the shop. And lots of people looking at those cards didn't get that it said You Bet, didn't notice that it said You Bet, or didn't understand that it was a betting shop. And there was like a picture of a horse in the window, like they do, William Hill kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so by taking out You Bet, it kind of opened it up even more, because people often didn't notice it was a betting shop at all. And therefore, taking that word out meant that it didn't have to be a betting shop, it could be anything.
Mm.
And leaving the horse in there, sometimes people would notice that horse and then they'd be like, she's walking past a place where they sell horses, or like they'd make up some kind of reason why there was a horse or a picture of a horse, which kind of made it interesting to me, like knowing what I thought that should be and then seeing how people used it or ignored it.
Mm.
So, it's quite interesting.
I imagine people could actually probably use your cards as a form of research to see how people kind of understand and interpret different images, particularly when they're placed in juxtaposition with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's very interesting how you can put a lot of interpretation on one simple image.
Mm.
And part of it is the thing that Scott McCloud talks about in Understanding Comics, about this idea of the more cartoony or iconic the drawings become, the more potential meanings there are. So if you draw a photorealistic picture of a face, it can only be like one person. Mm. If you draw a face that's just like a circle with two dots and a line for a mouth, then that could be everyone.
Mm.
It's that kind of making things so simple that they could be anything, but not too simple that you lose the meaning of them.
Well, it's interesting that you should talk about interpretation, because another project that you were involved in recently was you pitched a few pages of an adaptation of Macbeth to the International Graphic Shakespeare Competition. And that was a play that other people adapted for the same competition in a very different way. So it really is kind of illustrating the different ways you can approach a classic text from the medium of comics.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anyone's interested in seeing those entrants, they are on Facebook somewhere.
Mm.
And the amount of variety that was in the Graphic Shakespeare competition was amazing. And seeing how different people interpreted things, different sorts of spins they would put on it, is really fun. Even looking at the styles aside, just thinking about how people have decided to change the narrative and set it in different places, or make it a comedy, or sort of looking at genres and styles and settings and taking the sort of the same basic things and changing them.
Mm.
I think that's what is appealing about Shakespeare, really, is this kind of universal language and the way it still resonates with people over hundreds of years and keeps getting reinterpreted.
What was there, a prize or a publishing contract of some description that the winning entry had, or was it more of a showcase for artists to say, this is how I would interpret Shakespeare if I was asked to do a number of pages?
There was a prize and an exhibition, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting just looking, I've got four of your pages from Act One, Scene One of Macbeth in front of me, and it almost feels like even with each page, you're suggesting a different way that a block of text could be interpreted. So the first page is entirely silent with a raven, I think a fox and a horse running alongside each other. Then the next one is more of a splash page with the Macbeth Lego made out of skulls. Then there's a lovely six-panel interpretation of the three weird sisters talking, which focuses on bits of their anatomy. So it's almost like you're using it as a kind of portfolio task, saying, you know, if you were to hire me for this kind of project, look at the variety of interpretations I could give you.
Yeah, it's interesting because it was quite a kind of an experimental thing where I had some time, I didn't have any work, and I thought, I'm going to do this because it'll be a fun project to try new things. And I did all this with a kind of brush pen that I don't normally use. It's a bit looser as well. So I was like, oh, I'm going to try and do some loose style things and and change things up a bit. But yeah, maybe it was a bit too mishmashy of different styles.
Oh, I liked it.
I quite liked it, but then there you go.
But in a way, I mean, a challenge you could almost set with the playing cards you've created is to take a classic short narrative and then find cards within the set to retell that story and then ask someone else what they thought the story was that was presented in front of them.
That's a brilliant idea. That's amazing. What's been really nice of doing this this game is that you'll say to people, oh, here are the cards, and people can make up their own kind of games with it. And people come up with really interesting things like that. And there's someone, one of my backers on Kickstarter, who was messaging me yesterday saying, oh, I've come up with this idea for a game, or you could do this. This is a good idea for a game. And like about three or four different games that he came up with just kind of sparked the imagination and got him to think about these different things, which I think is great. This is what I wanted to do. This is what I want out of it, is to be able to have this kind of tool or this sort of system, and that everybody can use it to create their own kind of games and their own kind of exercises or challenges or ways of looking at things. Because, I mean, that's a brilliant idea. I think for that one, you might probably need to have a bigger deck of cards with more variety of different things in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a great idea. Like, put up a three-panel strip and say, what book is this of? Or, you know.
Well, I mean, or conversely, there's a film magazine called Vertigo, and they did an experiment about 10 years ago, I think, where they had a box of, I don't know, maybe 100 stock photos. Some of them, I think, they probably asked the photographer to create an image that was mysterious in order to, you know, create something that's provocative. And then they gave that box to, I think, 30 different filmmakers and asked them to make a one or two page comic by selecting photos and then adding a narrative in text boxes underneath. So you could do something similar with your cards. Maybe you could collaborate with comic writers to say, here are my pre-drawn panels. now create a narrative out of them.
Yeah, that would be fun. Or even better, have someone with a random deck of speech balloons and then randomly assign all of the speech balloons to all of the characters.
Nice.
See if it made any sense at all.
So, I mean, hopefully you do get to the final finish line of this Kickstarter and fund it. Then obviously there'll be distribution not only to people who have paid via Kickstarter, but presumably to comic shops and game shops as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first stage will be finishing the Kickstarter. Then it will be manufacturing the decks, fulfilling the Kickstarter, and then I will be taking them to various events and cons and talking to anyone who might want to distribute them or retail them. So that would be something that I will probably be looking into once I've got everybody their Kickstarter decks.
Mm. And then in terms of comics with a narrative, what might we expect from you in the near future?
That's a good question. You will see in the near future, there will be hopefully some more stories for the Phoenix. And there's also something that one of them has come out already, and there's another one coming out soon, which are comic strip abstracts of academic papers.
Huh.
I've been doing a couple of those for LSE.
Mm.
And so they are around currently as well.
Okay. What kind of subjects?
One was about anthropology, and it's about ethnography and what it is and why it's done and why it's useful.
Hmm.
So it's when anthropologists or people from other disciplines spend like an extended period with a group of people sort of trying to learn everything about them in a kind of holistic way in and thinking about what the impacts of those things are and what the relevance of it is.
Mm.
And the other one is about, it's more of a kind of economic paper, and it's about whether the neighbourhoods in which you raise your teenagers affect their academic abilities at school.
Mm. How did you get those gigs?
That was the LSE library that asked me if I would do those. And they're quite interesting. I'm going to put them up on my website at some point when I first do my Kickstarter things.
Mm.
So you'll be able to see those. And also the LSE library will have them on their accessible catalogue, so you can look at them there.
Okay. Have you got an official title at the LSE? Because it strikes me as that would be another great kind of artist-in-residence kind of task. That you could almost advertise it to everyone in the faculty saying, are you sick of illustrating your PowerPoints with clip art and photos from Google? Commission Karen to illustrate your PowerPoints to make them more interesting to the students.
That does sound interesting. I don't know. That would be nice.
Mm.
At the moment, it's just a kind of a one-off thing that I was doing for the library. So to sort of kind of make, to increase sort of accessibility to...
Mm.
To these sort of papers that people might not normally read, but if they were in a comic strip, then people will read them. And I know the feeling of that. Like, if it's in a comic, I'll read it, regardless of what the subject matter is.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, there has been some research on that. I went to a talk at UAL last year where someone was discussing doing that kind of research with students, that they presented just a traditional textbook page about a subject. It was some science related subject. Then they presented it as a comic where the images and the panels were related to what the subject was. And then they presented it as a random comic. So there might be a panel of a beach ball with a speech balloon coming out of it and talking about the subject. And then they analysed which was the easiest for students to kind of grasp the concept and take it on board. And needless to say, the one that was the traditional comic was the one that was the most successful. So
yeah, comics are great.
And on that bombshell, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Everyone's going to get really sick of me going on and on about comic fans now.
Oh, not at all. So many people do Kickstarters these days, you know. I think it's quite common for comic creators to be using social media to buy my product.
It's interesting though, because normally on Twitter I'll go on there like once every 3 weeks and post one tweet, and now it's just like every day, oh no, Comic Sans.
For more information about Karen Rubin's Kickstarter for the game Comic Turns, which provides the player with a pack of comic book themed cards, all featuring silent, ambiguous comic book panels that can be used to construct narratives and all sorts of other games that players can invent, please go to tinyurl.com/comicturns, which will take you to the Kickstarter page. The Kickstarter ends at 3 p.m. on Tuesday, March the 13th, and if the Kickstarter gets to the stretch goal of £5,000, then there'll be an additional set of challenge cards added to the deck, which add a whole new variety of stories that can be created from the selection. If you're listening to this before Saturday, March the 10th, then there's a session at the Cartoon Museum on Little Russell Street in London from 2 p.m. where you can have a go at playing comic turns and meet the creator. The event is free, but you still have to pay to get into the museum, which is well worth the price of admission. £7 for adults, £5 concessions, £3 for students, and children under 18 are free. The exhibition that's currently on display at the Cartoon Museum and runs until the 25th of March is Daily Funnies, an exhibition of strip cartoons, which contains a variety of fantastic cartoon strips from newspapers and magazines from over the past 100 years, featuring work by Alex, Jeff Hawke, Biff, Stephen Appleby, and many more. For more information about the Cartoon Museum, please go to cartoonmuseum.org. Karen Rubens can be found at karenrubens.com. That's karenrubins.com, where you can find examples of Karen's work over the last decade, including excerpts from Tales That Give You the Shivers from the Phoenix comic and her Macbeth adaptation that was entered into the comic book Shakespeare competition. You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM and DAB in London. I'm Alex Fitch, and if you're just joining us, then I'm afraid you've just missed my interview with Karen Rubens about her comic book card game Comic Turns. However, this will be available shortly as a podcast from www.panelborders.wordpress.com. In the second half of today's show, I'm talking to artist Bob Molesworth. Bob has worked on a variety of small press comics over the years, including Dino Corps, Endangered Weapon B, The Psychedelic Journal of Time Travel, as well as illustrating releases by Professor Elemental, and more recently working on Star Wars comics, including the new Star Wars Lego comic, available in British and German newsagents. My interview with Bob was recorded at Cartoon County, a monthly meeting for Sussex-based cartoonists and fans of the medium, that meets on the last Monday of the month at the Southern Bell pub in Hove from 6:30 p.m. So you'll have to forgive the background noise.
So Bob is probably best known for working on licensed comics like Star Wars and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but I thought we'd go back into the mists of time and have a look at your early stuff just to introduce the audience to your style.
Yeah, cool.
I hadn't realised that, other than Aces Weekly, I hadn't realised that there was a digital comics anthology until I googled your work on the internet. Tell me about Pulse.
I know nothing about Pulse.
How did your work end up in it?
Apparently in it. Yeah, I did a couple of graphic novels with Marcosia, and he was talking, Harry from Marcosia was talking about this amazing digital platform that they're setting up, and this was it, Pulse. And the graphic novels were going to be serialised and released, I don't know, sort of 10 pages at a time or something like that, I guess. I've never even seen it, and I forgot it existed until you showed me on the screen.
I don't feel so bad now.
But I hope it's doing well.
Yeah. So you drew two strips for Pulse, apparently.
Yeah.
Dino Corps and Endangered Weapon B and the Tentacles of Doom. How did working for Marcosia come about?
It started with Endangered Weapon B, where I did. I was editing a small press comic for a little while and taking submissions, and this guy sent me a 10-page script, David Tallerman, sent me the script, and I just thought, that's brilliant, I really want to draw that. And yeah, so I drew it, did a mini comic, and just went around conventions seeing if anybody was interested in doing something bigger. And Marcosia liked it, and they were prepared to allow me to do a graphic novel of Endangered Weapon B and publish it. And Dino Corps kind of ties into that, because halfway through Endangered Weapon B, Harry said, "Oh no, I've got this great idea, can you do this?" And I was like, "Yeah, okay, sounds brilliant, you know, space dinosaurs with laser guns, can't go wrong." So I ended up doing two. Yeah.
And the small press anthology, was that the psychedelic journal of time travel?
No. although I was in that as well. I'd started working professionally at this point, and there's a guy called Owen that runs a psychedelic journal of time travel. I just really liked it, and he had a script to draw, and I thought, yeah, why not? Give it a go. It's just a short piece. It was basically a telephone prank with some time travel thrown in, but it was quite fun.
So. Well, if it worked for Bill and Ted.
Yeah.
And I saw that you were presumably you were trying to get work in licensed comics because you did some Scooby-Doo pages that you were using as portfolio work. Yeah. Were you taking this round various publishers at conventions?
Yeah, well, I was deliberately targeting Panini. And so I thought I'd have a go at doing some licenses that Panini do. And I quite like Scooby-Doo. I thought I could probably draw it fairly convincingly. So I did a few short Scooby-Doo stories. And I guess it worked because I ended up working for Panini later on. So, yeah.
Was it particularly British newsagent comics that you wanted to see your work in?
Well, very pragmatically, yeah. I identified a market that I thought I was probably good enough to work in if I tried hard enough. The whole kind of American superhero thing just seemed kind of impenetrable to me at that time. Still does, really. So I didn't even try. And I just thought, well, what could I conceivably have a job in? And I thought, yeah, I could probably do that.
You mentioned a small press anthology. So you had self-published work before you got gigs with Marcosio and Panini.
Yeah, I had. So I used to work with a group of people in Brighton that we were called Under Fire. And Rapid Fire was the magazine we made. And that was going back quite a while. And we all had a go at editing, writing, drawing. It was good fun. That's kind of where it started for me.
And how did you find that experience of the sort of putting work out there that was handmade and stapled and presumably sold at conventions and hopefully in Dave's?
Yeah, I did sell some in Dave's. It was always kind of hard work, but ultimately really rewarding because it's what we all wanted to do. And so, getting to work on your own stuff's always fun.
And you also collaborated with local chap hop artist, Professor Elemental.
Yeah, it did. And this kind of links back to the psychedelic journal of time travel, because the guy who is the biographer for Professor Elemental...
He has a biographer.
He has Chris Mole, his official biographer, and runs the Professor Elemental's comics. He worked for the psychedelic journal. And I met them at a convention, having done The Endangered Weapon B, and he quite liked that. And yeah, we kind of became friends, and then he ended up working with Professor Elemental. I think he was brilliant as well, so at the same time I was like watching his stuff on YouTube, and turns out he lives down the road as well, and we ended up making some comics together. So yeah.
Why isn't he here tonight?
I don't know, maybe I should have told him. All the glory myself.
So if you read the Ape Quest comic, does the album that comes with it work as a soundtrack to accompany the story?
Yeah, it does. I can pass this around if people want to have a look. So every page or two pages in there is kind of a scene from a rep that he's done. And again, it's another time travel thing with his time travel trousers. He's sort of looking for his lost Monkey Butler. It was the first time I've worked with a musician, and it was good fun.
Did that dictate a different kind of pace of storytelling?
Yeah, because every couple of pages is almost a self-contained mini-story, being like referencing a song, but then it all fits together as well. So it's probably a bit like doing anthology work, but really short anthology work, and a lot of it.
Nice. Star Wars.
Yeah.
Was this a dream job come true?
Yeah, it was. It was my first professional job as well, was working on the Clone Wars comics for Titan. Just before I got some work with Panini. done some work with them. And again, kind of ties back to what I was doing with Welcosia. Having produced a couple of graphic novels, I could then take them round to portfolio reviews. And if you've actually got a graphic novel, you could put on the table and say, well, I made this, then it shows a level of professionalism. I went to a portfolio review in Leeds, Thought Bubble 2012, and I decided on the first night there that I was going to quit my job on Monday when I got back. I was like, right, you know, I've had enough of this, whatever happens, I can't be doing this job anymore, so I'm going to quit work. Unfortunately, that same weekend, I managed to get in on the Star Wars Clone Wars comic, and it all worked out quite well.
Do you work digitally or pen and ink?
Yeah, digitally. Okay. It's a time-saving device. Working digitally, there's no scanning or cleaning up your scanned images. Also, you can edit your inks, which is really nice. So I can work at a quicker pace.
So I guess, because I was going to ask, obviously Marcosia's stuff is American comic book size, or British titles and magazine size.
Yeah.
Did that make any difference, working on a slightly larger page when it came to creating the art?
Yeah, not really, because whatever I'm working on the screen size. Mm. So other than just how to create a new page document at a different dimension, yeah, it's just the same really. Although I prefer looking at work in the American format, being a bit smaller hides some of the mistakes a bit better.
When you're doing a licensed comic like Star Wars, how much editorial kind of advice, for a better word, is there? You know, that you have to absolutely obey the rules of the license and the look of the characters and so on.
Yeah, it depends. From different properties and different license holders have different levels of involvement. When I started working on Clone Wars, it was in a bit of limbo, really, because there was nothing happening cinematically with Star Wars at that time, and they were kind of wrapping up the Clone Wars cartoon, so I don't think they were that fussed. As long as a magazine was out and there was something on the shelves, so I didn't have too much interference. There was a classic page I was drawing where Anakin was in a speeder bike chase flying through a city, and I actually forgot to draw Anakin on the bike. It went off to approval. I didn't notice it got approved, and it came to the colouring stage, and I noticed, I was like, better put Anakin back in there. But then...
So it was just the bike flying by itself.
Just the bike flying by itself.
Why would you leave these things alone?
Yeah. But then when they launched Star Wars Rebels and I started working on that one, being a new property, they were a lot more concerned about how it looked. And yeah, there were a few redraws and they were a bit more on the case with that. I think with new properties, my experience is they tend to be more involved. If it's been running for a while, it gets a bit more relaxed.
And obviously Rebels and Clone Wars are both cartoons. Mm. So did that mean you also have to draw slightly more in the style of the animation?
I don't know. I try to, but I notice that other artists don't necessarily. And as the Rebels magazine's been going on, I think I've sort of deviated more from the cartoon style. But initially, to get the job, I was trying to draw it to look as much like the screen captures that I could see, because it was before the cartoon was released, so I was just working from stills. Yeah, I wanted to get it to look as close to as I possibly could.
I mean, obviously, you are going to want to bring your own style to the page whenever possible, even when you are working on a license.
Mm.
Who would you say were the artists that were kind of formative in helping you develop a style?
Yeah, probably less so comic artists and more animation. Like Bruce Timm, for example, was a big influence from his Batman cartoons. And the Clone Wars cartoon, before they did the CGI one, there was a 2D one.
Oh, the Jendy Tartakovsky one.
That's the one. And looking at my Clone Wars stuff, I don't know, you might be able to see a resemblance, an influence. Yeah, that's kind of what I was inspired by. I had to make it fit with what was happening at the time as well. Yeah.
Mm.
Other than that, the artists that inspire me tend to be the people I work with quite closely, like Ingo Rømling from The Rebels. I think his work's amazing, and every time I get one of his issues, I'm insanely jealous. And the Ninja Turtles, there's Cosmo White, who's also a Brighton guy, and he's been a big influence over the years as well. I started out when I was doing the rapid fire stuff with him as well. So, sort of grown together in that way.
Was the Turtles comic that you pitched for, or did they approach you once your Star Wars stuff was out?
It was actually Cosmo that got me into the Ninja Turtles comic, because he was working on it, and I think they had a crisis because they couldn't find an artist. None of the guys could do anything, and Cosmo just emailed me and said, "Oh, Bob, do you want to do Turtles?" I was like, "Yeah." He was like, "Well, email Ed now," Ed being the editor. And basically the deal was, if I could start before lunchtime, I got the gig. So I went, "Yeah, of course." I think he got in a bit of trouble with that, because he started me working on the issue before I'd been approved by Nickelodeon, and I don't think they were too pleased, but, you know, in the end, a magazine was made that kept me on, so everyone was happy.
And your style for Turtles seems to be, actually, for want of a better word, a bit more cartoony.
There was a house style that I had to work to on this one, and Nickelodeon were very, very hot on you working in the way they wanted. But again, this page is from later on, as it developed, it got a bit more relaxed, and I sort of found that I was developing in two different ways. So my Turtles work was going in one direction, my Star Wars work was going in another direction, almost completely at odds with each other. And every now and again, I'd try and sort of marry it up and make sure that it always worked.
You mentioned that the other Star Wars comic, you forgot to draw Anakin until you saw the colouring. Yeah. Do you do the colouring as well, or do you just do the black and white and then hand it on to someone else?
Mostly, I do the colouring. Okay. The Ninja Turtles, they have a house colourist, so all of that gets handed over to a guy called Jason Cardi, who's really good, so I'm quite happy to see him colour my work. The Clone Wars, they did have a house colourist, but I wasn't too keen on him, to be honest, so I ended up doing it mostly myself. And with the Star Wars Rebels, like this stuff, it was part of the deal. They wanted someone to do the whole job. And did it all.
And it's quite painterly, the colouring you've done for that, even though presumably it's all digital.
Thank you. Yeah. Inspired, again, by a lot of animation and Scooby-Doo as well, old Disney stuff. If you look at it, the characters, they're all kind of cel-animated. The backgrounds are really heavily hand-painted. And so there's influences from all that coming into it. I find it works as well if you've got quite a bold character. It really stands out against the background, and you can be a bit more loose with the background. And sometimes the looser you are, the better, because you don't always want it to be too prominent, but then sometimes you do.
In terms of colouring, you've also brought out a colouring book.
Uh-huh.
So you're really opening yourself up there to crayons, spray paint, finger painting. Have people come back to you with a coloured version of your own work, and you've been impressed, depressed?
Wrong. It's the wrong colours. It should have been like this. I've seen a couple of coloured ones. And it's all good. That's what it's there for. I don't particularly want to get involved in colouring this myself. I kind of feel like my part of it is to do the black and white, and then I want to hand it over. I don't want to take any ownership of colours, I suppose, because then if I see someone that's done colours, then it's always like what I've done in mind as well. I'm just happy for it to be open to whatever. Yeah, it was good fun doing, and I mostly did a colouring book because I thought I could probably do that in about a month. And trying to fit my own stuff in between work is always tricky. I have a bad habit, or good habit, of accepting jobs when they come along. And any time I start something, inevitably halfway through, someone will go, "Bob, we need an issue out next week." And I'm going, "Yeah, okay." And so it'll get shelved. But yeah, I thought this was something that was actually quite achievable that I could probably do. So yeah, it's good.
I mean, I wouldn't accuse you of getting on the adult colouring book bandwagon, but certainly if you are going to bring out, you know, a portfolio of black and white images, it means, I guess, you can concentrate on just making interesting individual images rather than beholden to a story in doing so.
And that's what it kind of came to me as well. As I was doing it, I found that loads of ideas that I had had floating around in the back of my mind for like the last 20 years started to come out, and it was a really good experience doing that. And I felt
amazed. This is a plate for colouring.
Yeah, cool. it's the gentleman here that suggested the printers. I thought, there's only 20 pages in it, so I better make sure the paper's good heavyweight and the cover feels really nice. But it was like, I felt like I'd made 20 pieces of artwork that I actually wanted to make. And I was quite pleased that I haven't done that.
Yeah. So obviously, and the next project you're doing, if you're allowed to, you put them in the PDF so people can see them, is a Star Wars Lego comic, which is quite an interesting idea. I mean, I know the whole kind of Lego versions of things has become a real phenomenon in recent years, but to have to do a Lego version of recognisable characters must be a weird kind of like juggling act to do in your head.
Well, fortunately, everything that goes into the comic character-wise, there's already a toy of.
Okay.
And the more toys that you draw in the comic, the happier they are. So, there's always reference. I don't really have to make anything up. But what you were saying about likenesses, working for Lego, they really want it to be exact. I can see on that Poe Dameron at the bottom now, I wouldn't get away with that because his eyes are slightly too far apart. They'd make me shift them together. They're really hot on that, and there's not a lot of room for artistic interpretation. But on the other hand, it gives you a very clear and very defined idea of what they want, and it's kind of nice to have it that straightforward, that you know that exactly what you've got to deliver, and then it's just a case of doing that.
And then I suppose, because it's so locked down, the star and the likeness, you can concentrate more on sort of being the director, as it were, of each frame. You know, thinking of the layout and the perspective and the angle.
Yeah.
The mise-en-scène, if I may.
I think that's right. And I think as there's a lack of creative input in the actual imagery, it comes out in other ways. Yeah, the particular camera angles that I use and the sort of the atmospherics of it, the environmental stuff, the backgrounds, I can get a bit more painterly on as well. Some backgrounds there will be Lego models for, and then I'll draw the Lego ones, and some backgrounds there won't, and then I'll just make it real world and they're happy with that. I should probably point out, just for the sake of the microphone right now, that all these pictures, they're practice pages, so nothing that's up here is actually going to be published. And the reason I've got practice pages is because my first Lego issue is due to be released in January.
So you've done a lot of work on licensed properties, various iterations of Star Wars, Turtles and so on. But obviously you still have an urge to do creator-controlled stuff like your colouring book. Yeah. Are there more stories in you that you want to tell, you know, in the years to come?
There is a story in me now I want to tell. It's just a case of finding the time to do it and finding an outlet for it as well. I've got an idea for just a short body horror story that I'd really like to tell. And write as well. I think it'd be really interesting because I haven't done any writing myself in, I don't know, 5 or 6 years probably. We'll see. I'd like to think that I'd get the time perhaps in the next year.
For people not in the know, Bob is very kindly here tonight when his partner could go into labour at any second. So if he runs out of the room, he's just got a text saying so.
Well, she hadn't gone into labour when I left the house, and I figure it will take probably a good 24 hours before the baby arrives, so okay. Probably all right. Yeah. But you're right.
On that bombshell, does anyone in the audience have any questions for Bob?
Yeah, I just got a quick. I thought that part robot thing was actually I mean, I saw it was a colouring book, but I actually thought it was I thought it was part of a story. I mean, so what is it? Is it just a colouring book, or is there no story there?
There's a story there. Yeah.
There's a story in the colouring book.
A story. Every page has got a story, and they all kind of work together. It was a sort of a life cycle of kind of birth to death and bits in between and war and life. And it was influenced by various things that I was watching at the time. There's like an Adam Curtis documentary that made it in there in a form of referencing. It's about wars in Afghanistan. There's a particular bit of film he took really touched me, and I translated that into a bit more of a robot-y thing. Also, with it being a colouring book, I kind of hope that as people spend a bit more time with each image, I guess you'd take maybe an hour or two colouring it, then maybe what I was drawing might sink in a bit more. Whereas with comic books, and particularly licensed stuff, every panel you probably look at for, well, a minute tops, and then you've moved on and never pick it up again. So I was hoping that it would sort of stay with people a little bit.
Interactive.
Yeah, well, colouring books, one of the most simple forms of interactive art and storytelling you can do, isn't it, really?
It's like, well, yeah, except people don't actually read, they just colour images. Yeah. It's an interesting idea.
But if you want to do that, then that's fine. There's absolutely no judgement on my part. Once I've drawn it and you've bought it, it's yours. You do with it as you like. I'd be quite interested to see what people do with it. Yeah, there was an intention there. The meditation colouring books are a big thing as well, and that was part of it. And some of the pages were kind of drawing on Buddhist and Hindu meditation and mantra imagery. There's a few thingamies, mandalas in there. Also mixed with a fairly high amount of psychedelic imagery and other things that I've been influenced by since my university days, really, when I was like 20.
So you're interested in mysticism?
I'm interested in religious iconography. Can't say it, but I like it. Yeah, I'm not a religious person. But I do like some of the images. And again, I got quite heavily into Hindu art off the back of psychedelic art, and I found there was a massive crossover. Pretty sure that a lot of the people that are creating this artwork were quite off their heads. I like that. Yeah. So it's all... I was tying it back, you see. I was bringing the religious stuff back to the psychedelic.
And are you going to use that kind of... any of that in your story, the horror story? Image?
No, it'll probably be more of a straight body horror. Kind of post-apocalyptic thing is the idea. Probably nothing psychedelic much, and I say that it might be perhaps more in the storytelling rather than the imagery that I'll use. But I'm not going to go too much into that because they will spoil it when I actually make it.
You were talking about Lovecraft earlier, and there's the whole cosmic thing in with Lovecraft, so you'd be tempted to use that in some way.
Yeah, I do like the cosmic horror element and the kind of the existential horror of H.P. Lovecraft is brilliant. Say now. Yeah, that probably won't also be in this story, but there are things that I like to work with, things that I'm really interested in, and perhaps deserve a bigger space. Maybe an ongoing series or mini series or a graphic novel. I'm not being that ambitious at the moment. I'm thinking more sort of 10 or 15 pages is probably what I can realistically manage and get finished alongside working. Nice as it would be to be able to delve into a massive, long creator-owned project. I also need to earn money, especially having a child on the way, and so the licensed work is what keeps me going.
With the licensing work, I mean,
Because lots of those sort of magazines, it's usually sort of 5-page strips, isn't it, and sort of anthology stuff. I mean,
yeah.
What's your sort of page rate? Not the pay, but is that how fast you work?
Right. Okay. About 2 days. 2 days to do a full page on average.
Right. So that's right the way through in full colours.
Yeah. I take about a day to draw it, and then about a day to ink and colour. Which most of the stuff I work on is sort of 10 or 12 pages, and it works out to be about a month's work per issue.
Mm. Anyone else? I mean, it's interesting that the Marcosia strips you did for the anthology that no one heard of were collected in print, so at least you know that there's a nice... Well, you showed us one.
Oh, no, they were the original graphics.
Oh, I see, so it's the other way around.
Yeah, so that's really odd. Digital platform that was launched afterwards, and I then serialised what I'd already done to try and release in a new way, thinking that everybody's going to be reading comics on iPads, which, oh, no, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that anyone read that one. I hope it did well.
Mm. But I mean, what I was getting at was that, you know, at least with the Marcosia stuff, it's a nice kind of chunky format with the spine, and it has kind of a durability. Mm. While the licensed stuff, particularly for British comics, may never be collected. It's far more ephemeral in a way, that it's kind of there and then it's gone.
Yeah.
Does that bother you, you know, that it sort of has less of a legacy?
It is actually something that the sort of longevity of a piece of work does sort of matter. I'm constantly craving something that has lasting value, that's not just seen and thrown away within a month. But then I do gather a lot of the stuff I do is collected into collected volumes. I just never hear about it.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's good.
Well, I have a few that I have from the people that license Rebels is a German company, nearly Deutschland, and they always send me one when they've done them. So I've got that, and there was a Ninja Turtles anthology, just one that was made as well. So it's nice to see that and to be part of something that maybe has a shelf life.
Anyone else?
If you like Lovecraft, I was going to mention I've just finished a book by Mary Shelley. I don't know if you read it. It's called The Last Man, which is, it's basically about the extinction of humanity, and she wrote it beginning of the 18th century, I guess. Mm-hmm. It was kind of panned immediately, partly because it was by a woman, we shouldn't write about things like that in those days, and also it was because her political views were suspect.
Yeah.
But it's sort of the first half is quite... It's about how these people, you know, they're getting on with their lives and how it all just surveils. And the second half, I mean, it's completely mind-blowing. I mean, if you're into Lovecraft and that whole kind of existential thing, I think I can honestly say it's one of the most powerful books I've ever read. I mean, it's worth having a look at.
Cool, I'll definitely look that up. That's probably the sort of stuff that Lovecraft was reading and aspiring to.
It wouldn't surprise me, actually, I think you're right. Obviously Frankenstein and all that stuff. It really is. Because you think the extinction of humanity, how are you going to convincingly portray something so existential, you know? It does. I mean, you really do. I mean, I did anyway, just reading it. It was quite a powerful experience, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I guess Frankenstein also, I mean, that was what stealing the life-giving powers of the gods, wasn't it? It's also the Prometheus, and so it probably ties in. And once you've stolen the power of the gods, the next thing is the existential crisis of, you know, there is a god and he doesn't care about you.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why writing is so controversial, because it's like saying, well, you're saying to the Christian as well, you know, all your beliefs are just, they don't really mean anything. But it was also saying to all the Enlightenment thinkers who weren't Christians, but were all about progress and believing in art and all the rest of it. It was equally offensive to them. You know, it's just like, it's all crap. You know,
win-win.
Yeah. Anyone else? Well, on that,
I've got.
Yep.
I've got kids who are not quite Star Wars yet. They buy comics based on the toy.
Yeah.
On the condition of the character. Yeah. And then do the quizzes, and they get to the comic strip eventually. They go back and reread that bit over and over again.
Cool.
Do you get feedback at all? Because it's a sort of field you're working in. It's almost like the comic, your work is almost the icing on the cake.
Right, yeah.
It's not the cake.
Yeah.
You've been working on the cake side.
I do, and the best feedback I get is when I go to conventions and I get kids queuing up to see a guy that drew Star Wars. They don't particularly care who I am. It's just like, that guy drew Star Wars.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's exciting, and they'll come and I'll do them a picture and they go away happy. And that's the best kind of feedback, the best feeling you can get from it. And also, I think that is... it's quite important to be able to connect as well occasionally with your customer base. Otherwise, you are just like sitting in this room producing something abstractly for people that you'll never know or see. And yeah.
You put a lot of work in something that... it's almost anonymous in that, like you said, they think you're the man who stole it.
Yeah.
They probably think you're George Lucas if they know anything at all.
Well, I've sort of had that as well. When I'll go into a school as well, occasionally I'm invited to go in and do a talk. And I had one kid asking me about whether Princess Leia was wearing underwear in the first film. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. You'll have to ask George Lucas next time you see him. Which is the best way I can think of dodging the question. But yeah, they don't really get that I've never met George Lucas. You know, if ever I did, it would be really nice. But
I'm not asking.
next time I see him, yeah. But yeah, I am kind of disconnected from the rest of the industry, in as much as the only contact I have with anyone is through emails generally, because we all work from different countries. Occasionally I get to meet the guys in Germany, and as we'll go over there and do some conventions together. That's good.
Are German fans different to British ones?
Yes. Yeah, the German fans do actually know who I am.
Wow.
Yeah. Do you know who I am? Yeah. And seek me out on Facebook and become friends and follow me and, actually have a kind of an ongoing relationship with feedback through some of the German fans. And not just German as well, but around that sort of area of Europe. Denmark as well. There's some massive collectors. There's a guy called Eddie from Denmark, and I get to see all his collections on Facebook all the time, and he's like a Star Wars super fan, and it's quite nice to have that connection as well, to see where my work ends up and who's reading it. Yeah.
Cool. Bob Molesworth, thank you very much.
For more information about Bob Molesworth's work, please go to tinyurl.com/BobMoles. And Star Wars Lego Magazine, featuring comics by Bob Molesworth, is available now in British newsagents. As I said earlier, my interview with Bob Molesworth was recorded at Cartoon County, a monthly meeting for Sussex-based cartoonists and fans of the medium. Cartoon County takes place on the last Monday of the month, at the Southern Bell Pub in Hove from 6:30 p.m, with the next meeting taking place on the 26th of March, and our guest is Lucy Sullivan, who'll be talking about her Unbound graphic novel Barking. Before then, there are various comic book events taking place in London. At GOSH, 1 Berwick Street in Soho, they have a launch for the collection of the webcomic No Faces, published by the collective King Louis Lab. Ben Williams will also be releasing his new book, Spot, and there'll be a variety of No Faces merchandise available on the night as well, from 7 p.m. on Friday the 9th of March. On March the 15th, Ryan Hughes will be launching his latest book, Logo A Go-Go, and talking about the project, and that's taking place on Thursday, March the 15th, from 7:30 p.m. And then the following day, on March the 16th, there's the launch of Professor Astrocat's Human Body Odyssey, and that's from 7 p.m. On March the 22nd, there's the launch of R by DCWB and Entity Reunion by Alexander Tucker, two new creations by musicians-turned-artists David C.W. Briggs and Alexander Tucker, and that's taking place on the 22nd of March from 7 p.m. For more information about all GOSH events, please go to goshlondon.com. At Orbital Comics, 8 Great Newport Street, near Leicester Square Tube, their current exhibition is called The Carnival's Toy Box, which features weird and wonderful creations based on classic American serials, toys, and Saturday morning cartoons. Following that, from the 16th of March, there's a solo exhibition by Remy Boydell, featuring work from the New Image Comics graphic novel, The Pervert. And then on Saturday the 14th of April, comic book painter and cover artist Lucio Perillo will be in the store signing, sketching and live painting from 12 till 6 p.m. And that's on Saturday the 14th of April. For more information about all Orbital events, please go to orbitalcomics.com. At the Forbidden Planet Megastore on Shaftesbury Avenue in London, they have a signing of Dead Canary Comics anthology title Adventures in Science, featuring work by Krent Abel, Jeff Senior, Shaky Kane and Mark Stafford, who'll be in the store along with Dead Canary Press's Matt Fitch and Chris Baker, signing copies of the anthology on Saturday the 31st of March from 1 to 2 p.m. Then on Wednesday the 11th of April, Rob Williams will be signing the new Kingsman graphic novel, Red Diamond, from 6 p.m. And then on Saturday the 21st of April, Dan Abnett will be in the store from 1 p.m. signing the new comic book based on the classic Hammer movie, Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter. For more information about all Forbidden Planet events, please go to forbiddenplanet.com/events. Panel Borders was recorded, edited and introduced by Alex Fitch and is a Panel Borders production. And you can find all previous episodes on our blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. With recent interviews including Stuart Lee, Josie Long, DJ Food, The Surreal McCoy, Gerard Way, and many more. If you enjoy the programme and would like to contribute to the running costs, including travel to various events where interviews are recorded and new equipment, please go to patreon.com/panelborders, where you can receive behind-the-scenes information, special edits and transcripts of programmes, and much more. And the next episode will be broadcast on Resonance FM on the first Wednesday in April. Thanks for listening.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.